Jerry Rafferty's Baker Street made its debut on the charts this week in 1978 on its way to becoming a top 10 international hit and a source of a little controversy, at least for a while. It was Rafferty's first release in 3 years. He'd been part of a band called Steeler's Wheel with childhood friend Joe Egan and a revolving set of backup musicians. The band had broken up amid a flurry of lawsuits in the mid-70s, and Rafferty was prevented by litigation from recording for 3 years. Baker Street was the signal he was back. The song is best known for the saxophone solo by session musician Raphael Ravenscroft. He was paid about $50 for the session. That was a standard fee for a studio musician. There was a story going around that the check for the session fee bounced, while Rafferty went on to earn about $150,000 a year in royalties. But Ravenscroft denied that story before he died last year. What is true is that Ravenscroft was always irritated by the legendary solo he created because he complained it was out of tune. In fact, during the final mix of the session, the solo was speeded up to make the recording more energetic. Speeding it up also changed the key. But sharp or flat, Rafe Ravenscroft's solo on Baker Street is credited with a surge in sales of saxophones in the late 70s, along with a renewed interest in the instrument in pop music and advertising. Last week I talked about Damn Yankees opening on Broadway and how it became a commercial success only after the producers changed the picture on the posters to show Gwen Verdon in what was a pretty racy outfit for 1955. The outfit was created by successful designers William and Jean Eckhart, who also designed the other costumes and sets for Damn Yankees. Soon after, they decided to become producers, and their first show opened exactly 4 years later, this week in 1959. They found their first project when they were invited to attend a show written for a summer theater by some friends, including Mary Rogers, the daughter of composer Richard Rogers. The show was a comic retelling of Hans Christian Andersen's The Princess and the Pea. When the Eckharts saw the show, they knew they'd found their first project, and they brought in veteran director George Abbott, who'd also directed Damn Yankees. Abbott's first big challenge was to find someone to play the central character, Princess Winifred the Woebegone. He had his choice of Broadway's leading ladies, but he wanted a fresh face, and Abbott's daughter found that face performing in a New York nightclub.
Where'er I roam, my heart grows dank and cold. My face grows gray when shadows fall and I hear the
Carol Burnett was just beginning to make waves in New York with appearances on Jack Parr's Tonight Show and other TV variety programs when she was seen in that nightclub act by George Abbott's daughter. But it was her performance in the show that became known as Once Upon a Mattress that led to a regular stint on The Gary Moore Show, ultimately a very successful career, and her own TV variety series. Director George Abbott did have one other casting problem in finding the right actress to play the evil Queen Agravaine. Without question, the best candidate for the job was a woman named Jane White. The thing that concerned Abbott was that Jane was an African-American. He thought the presence of a black queen in medieval England would distract a 1959 audience, so he made a request, and Jane White agreed to do the role in white makeup. Incidentally, Jane was the daughter of Walter White, the founder of the NAACP, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. Apparently, he did not object to his daughter's decision to appear in whiteface. Incidentally, a few years ago, they made a TV movie version of Once Upon a Mattress, and the choice of the actress to play Queen Agravaine was not a difficult one at all. Carol Burnett did the role. Once Upon a Mattress ran for 18 months. Mary Rogers was nominated for a Tony for her music, but she lost to her dad. Richard Rogers created The Sound of Music the same year. Now, the career of Richard Rogers spanned two major phases, the one he's best known for today, writing musicals such as The Sound of Music with Oscar Hammerstein, and the earlier phase with lyricist Lorenz Hart, in which they wrote dozens of classic songs for mainly forgettable shows. But until this week in 1925, it appeared unlikely that either phase would happen at all. Rodgers and Hart had written some tunes for mostly amateur musicals in New York, but nothing had clicked and they were still unknown. Rodgers was about to abandon any hope of ever becoming a Broadway composer until he and Larry Hart were asked to write songs for a show called The Garrick Gaieties. The Gaieties opened 90 years ago this week and introduced this song.
We'll have Manhattan, the Bronx and Staten Island too. It's lovely going through the zoo.
That's Ella Fitzgerald singing Manhattan from her Rodgers and Hart songbook album. Manhattan was written just to be a scene change song. It was meant to be sung in front of the main curtain while the crew was changing the sets in back. But when the audience of New Yorkers heard the ode to their city, they lost all interest in whatever was to come next. They demanded an encore, and then another one, and then another one. They kept demanding to hear the song throughout the show. It was the Broadway version of an instant request line in an era before the radio was a household item. When the show ended, the audience demanded the orchestra play Manhattan again and again and again until each and every patron had learned the words and everybody was singing along. That was how hit songs were born. Manhattan became the first hit song for Rodgers and Hart, the Garrick Gaieties became a Broadway institution, and Richard Rodgers did not have to start looking for a new job. With this week's Musical Almanac, I'm Scott Walker.
The city's glamour can never spoil the dreams of a boy and girl. We'll turn Manhattan into an isle of joy.